Well, welcome back to Word and Table, a bi-weekly podcast on liturgy, sacrament, and the great tradition of Christian worship, and why it is vital in our world today. I'm your host, Alex Wilgus, and I am here, as always, with Father Stephen Gauthier. Welcome back, Father Stephen.
Good to be back, Alex.
Father Stephen is the canon theologian of the Diocese of the Upper Midwest in the Anglican Church in North America, and is director of formation at St. Paul's House of Formation in the Greenhouse Movement. Today, Father Stephen, you know, just recently we did an episode on difficult passages in the Gospels. Really enjoyed that. But, you know, we skipped one of the most difficult passages in the Gospels that I wanted to double back to. And that's Jesus's...
Should I be nervous?
Yes, you should be very nervous.
Okay.
All kinds of controversy is about to explode. But Jesus said it, so let's get into it. So here it is. Some Pharisees came to him to test him. This is from Matthew 19. Some Pharisees came to him to test him. They asked, "Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any and every reason?" "Haven't you heard," he replied, "that at the beginning the Creator made them male and female and said, 'For this reason a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh?' So they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, if what God has joined together, let no one separate." "Why then," they asked, "did Moses command that a man give his wife a certificate of divorce and send her away?" Jesus replied, "Moses permitted you to divorce your wives because your hearts were hard. But it was not this way from the beginning. I tell you that anyone who divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another woman commits adultery." The disciples said to him, "If this is the situation between a husband and wife, it is better not to marry." So right there, the disciples are getting how
difficult, they're right on it, yes,
how hard this saying is. And of course, we're talking about marriage, and especially divorce and remarriage. So Father Stephen, let's get into it. First of all, what
may I make a remark here, just before we get into the core of this? Mm-hmm. Something that might interest people, of course, the specific reference that they give to the Old Testament, to the Law of Moses, actually is interesting. The Law of Moses nowhere authorized talks about divorce in the sense of saying, hey, it's okay to divorce. What it does say is it presumes that people are doing it, and it mitigates the damage. Mm. It simply says, if you're going to divorce your wife, they say, and in Jewish law it could only be on the husband's side. In Roman law it could be both ways. Uh-huh. That's why in Mark's gospel, we actually have it going both ways about a husband or a man or a woman.
Okay, Roman context.
Right, and Mark gives a Roman context. But the idea here was you can't leave her hanging. In the ancient world, a woman had to be connected with a father, a son, a husband. It was an economic necessity. And what men were doing is they would divorce their wife and move on, but if she didn't have a clear ability to remarry, if her legal status wasn't clear, she could be in this limbo. Mm. So actually, Moses' commandment is sort of a mitigation. It's sort of like saying an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. It wasn't a command to take an eye or a tooth. It was saying, don't do any more than that.
Yeah, got it.
Stop there.
Here and no farther.
And so in some ways, a way to look at that, and this is this very commandment presupposes a divorce, which was a reality, like slavery was a reality.
Right.
But it was actually the only thing, didn't say divorce was okay, it simply said it presumes this is happening, and if you're going to do this, you can't leave the woman hanging there, so you have to give her something that in Aramaic, to this day, Jews called a get, G-E-T, it stands for a certificate of divorce, meaning it made her, I can get remarried.
Right.
So I'm not stuck
destitute.
Here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, but it's clear that Jesus here is going a little bit further. And
that was just a footnote. Jesus is going way further because he gives us the theology of marriage. This is profound.
Yeah. So let's get into it. What is Jesus saying about marriage here that astonishes the disciples and the Pharisees?
Well, in most societies, have looked upon marriage as basically pretty much like a lease. You know, it's a contractual arrangement, and sometimes contractual arrangements work out. Sometimes they don't, and there are ways you get out of them. It's a contract like any other contract. And what Jesus is saying is something actually happens. For example, if you enter into a lease contract for your apartment, you're not a different person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But Jesus is saying, he says, they're no longer two, but one flesh. Jesus talks about an ontological change. Mm. You know, as a priest, I am the witness. You know, I celebrate marriages. I'm an officiant at marriages. And I like to say in my wedding sermon, as it were, saying, we're going to witness a miracle. Mm-hmm. Two separate people came in. But Jesus says they're no longer two, they're one. And he says, why? Because God has joined them together. Mm-hmm. And that's why he says, well, what God has joined together, man can't separate. Mm-hmm. So Jesus argues for the indissolubility of marriage. That means that marriage is unbreakable. And he goes on to say that's what he said. I'm saying if you get a, it doesn't matter that you, quote, get a divorce. So in the ancient world, the divorce meant you could remarry. Uh-huh. And he said, it doesn't matter. He said, I'm telling you, if you remarry after a divorce, you commit adultery. Mm-hmm. That's what he's saying in this passage. And it was shocking. The apostle said, wow, that means marriage really is for life? Boy, you'd have to think twice and three times. So yeah. That really is our context. It's interesting. You know, people who otherwise believe little about the New Testament, I'm a very conservative guy about scriptures. Mm-hmm. But there are people, obviously, who are unbelievers, and there's, for example, the famous Jesus seminar. You know, what did the historical Jesus of Nazareth say?
Oh, yes, kind of tweezing apart what supposedly the church says Jesus said, but what Jesus must really have actually said.
I reject the approach, but I think it's interesting that people like that said that there are two sayings that we know they would say for a fact. No one can argue Jesus said this is one of them.
No one can argue that Jesus didn't say this.
Yeah, you people, it's beyond dispute because they're saying it's so inconvenient people would have dropped it.
Got it.
It must have been undeniable that the church stayed with it.
Okay.
So again, we clearly have this as a pretty clear teaching. The shock of, by the way, when we read the Gospels, we often miss the fact it's the reaction shots are meant to tell us how to understand things. For example, remember the house of Jairus when Jesus is going to raise his daughter?
Yeah.
People laugh at him when he stays asleep. The point is so we don't think it was just a coma or something. Tons of people had seen and said, she's dead.
Yeah.
So it's to make sure we have no doubt about the context.
Sure.
So the context here is, maybe I misunderstood that. He said, no, people are shocked. Right. The apostles are, whoa, Lord.
Yeah.
They're saying, so this is a hard teaching.
Got it. Mm-hmm. So marriage is indissoluble, but then Jesus gives a caveat here. He says, except for sexual immorality. So does that, what does that mean? What does sexual immorality here mean? Does that mean your marriage can end if you commit some kind of sexual indiscretion?
Well, this has been debated in the church. But the traditional answer has been, first of all, it's very important the word that Jesus uses. He doesn't say adultery, which he uses, by the way, later on in this very passage. Hmm. The term he uses is porneia. This is a word for uncleanness, and it has the sense the church has understood for this. In the same passage, he uses the other word with adultery. How come he doesn't use adultery here except for adultery? Hmm. For a good reason. The reason is there are some things that went again. Just because somebody calls a marriage doesn't mean it's a marriage in a biblical sense. For example, Egyptians and Iranians sometimes in the ancient world married their sisters. Okay, and, you know, even though it would legally, quote, be a marriage, it's not a marriage. You know, the Bible says there are certain, you can't marry close relatives. And so no matter what the law calls it, it's not a marriage. They call it porneia. Remember, we have that two examples of that in the scripture. We have Herod. Remember, we have the example of Herod had taken his brother's wife. Hmm. And John the Baptist said, this is not lawful. This isn't a real marriage. Remember the woman, the Samaritan woman, where she says, you know, he said, call your husband. He said, well, I don't have a husband. He said, that's right. The guy you're living with isn't your husband.
Right. Yeah.
You've had five, but that man you're with is not your husband. So the traditional understanding of the church, you know, as far as the use of this term, and this is only in Matthew's account. The others are simply say, you know, don't give any exception clause. This exception clause is unique to Matthew, and he uses a different term. Was understood traditionally as saying, of course, we're not saying in situations you are married that would not actually meet the Christian definition of a marriage.
Right. Okay. So this is less about falling into sin and more is your marriage itself on the right ground? Is it lawful?
Is it a law? For example, in our society now, we're coming back to some of these things. Certainly in biblical terms, two men or two women cannot marry each other. Even the law says that. The law is the law.
The law of the United States, yeah.
The law of the United States says they can. But we're saying as far as the church should be concerned, you couldn't say, well, gee, you had been, you know, you can't marry someone because you've already been married. Well, two men have been, quote, married in American law, that would have nothing to say about their marital status as far as the church is concerned.
Right.
It wouldn't be a marriage as the Bible would teach what a marriage is.
So that's what Jesus means by porneia instead of adultery.
That's the traditional understanding. What he really meant, what he's meant, that was a traditional understanding, is there was something fundamentally wrong that prevented that. Even though there was legally, there's no question they were under the laws where they were, something meant it wasn't the kind of union Jesus talks about of God joining two people together and making them no longer two but one because God has joined. God doesn't join sin.
Right.
So that's not something God does.
Okay. So does that also, that division between legal marriage and the marriage as far as the church is concerned, does that cut the other way into divorce? What about a legal divorce? Does that have an effect on what the church sees as a marriage?
No, it doesn't. I mean, the law has no, spiritually, like Jesus said, it is what it is. He said that someone who's divorced his wife, he said marries another, has committed adultery. It doesn't matter. The law says they're free to marry. He said, Jesus denies the law has any effect.
Yeah.
So the fact he's saying the law cannot undo the law of God.
I see. Okay.
And therefore, just as the state can say something, the state could say if you're in ancient Egypt, you can marry your sister. It could say now a man can marry a man. That doesn't change the biblical reality that such a marriage, despite its legal status, is not a marriage in a biblical sense. And the same way is if there is a marriage in a biblical sense, getting a court to say differently doesn't change that fact.
I see.
And that's why Jesus said getting a divorce. Again, divorce meant that it was recognized that, in fact, a person was free to remarry.
Right, you know? Right. So, I mean, I feel like the tough reality of our time now, though, is that, in the 20th and 21st century now, is that a lot of people get divorced legally. And a lot of people come to our churches divorced, having already been divorced. So how does the church receive or deal with people in that situation?
Well, the good news when it comes to this, when people are coming and seeking to be remarried after they have been divorced, is first of all, not what Jesus is talking about, is talking, the biblical marriage. Is what we're talking about. Not everything that is a marriage, in fact, has met that standard. Sometimes the reason the marriage broke apart is because something was fatally wrong. For example, let's look at some of the critical things we're looking for in a marriage. What we're looking for is, first of all, a lifelong commitment. Exclusive fidelity. Sometimes that doesn't describe people today. Some people, when they enter into marriages, there are marriages where the vow has actually said, as long as love shall last.
I see, yeah. So
if people have never even entered in with the understanding that this is a lifelong, this will be, we'll try to make it work out. If it doesn't, it doesn't. That would be a problem. That's not, or sometimes an open, quote, they call open marriage. One I come home to. But obviously things happen and we sort of understand that's going to be the case. Well, that's not marriage in the sense of lifelong exclusive commitment. And open to the purposes of marriage. There are two clear biblical purposes. One is bonding and the other is procreation. Now, one certainly can be married and not sadly have the ability to have children. That doesn't prevent marriage. But if one does have the ability to have children, the marriage has to be open to children. Two people who are able to have children saying, we never intend to have children. For no good reason, simply as a matter of convenience, we choose not, like, just don't want to have them. Mm-hmm. No particular other than a lifestyle choice would not be. So the thing we need, the essential features of a marriage in a Christian sense, are lifelong. It's a lifelong commitment. It's for life. It's meant to be exclusive, fidelity, exclusive relationship. That's the only love, by the way, where we say, normally we say more is better. Like, you just have a second child now.
I've had
three. Yeah. And one of the things you have to say to your child is, when you have your little brother or little sister, we won't love you any the less. Normally, you have to say to people, more love doesn't take away from love from you. But the one love that's exclusive is marriage. We say, forsaking all others, remain faithful only to, we say, him or to her. That's why God uses marriage as an example of our relationship with him. It has to be exclusive.
So the love of children, for instance, is a kind of love that isn't diminished by loving more people. Actually, yeah, you're right. I did get to see this. Actually, my second son was born 2 weeks ago, and I just didn't think I had any more room in my heart to love my children as more than my son. But that turns out there's room.
Sure.
Anyway, just kind of a sidebar there.
But that's not true.
That's not how it is of marital.
With marriage. Yeah. So again, if we have those, on the simplest level, if we have an arrangement, people come together and legally they're married and later they divorce because, again, one of the partners, I've seen this as a priest, of course, in the process of dealing with troubled marriages where one of the partners never intended lifelong fidelity. They'll tell you that. They didn't see marriage that way. They try to make it work out.
Yeah.
They give it an honest try, but they certainly didn't see themselves as being bound. That kind of thing. Well, that wasn't the marriage that Jesus was talking about, where they're no longer two but one. So we're talking about those those characteristics. Also, it means there are things that can stop a marriage from taking place. So after the fact, we can look at when a marriage is broken up and people are saying, can I remarry?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have a civil divorce and the law has said I'm divorced, so they're certainly eligible to marry that way. But from the church's viewpoint, am I free to marry or am I still bound to the previous spouse?
Yeah.
And what you're looking for is there are basically two categories of things we're looking for that could indicate, are indicators to us, that the original situation, often that's why it's broke up, there was something wrong from the beginning mm-hmm. that stopped a marriage from, in a biblical sense, from happening. It was a legal marriage. People acted honorably, but it wasn't the kind of marriage Jesus was talking about. One involves a person has to be able to marry.
Mm.
So, for example, somebody who is too closely related, who is too young, for example, below the legal age of consent type of thing, or bigamy, a prior spouse is still alive in something that was clearly a valid marriage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Meaning like someone, one of the parties has another spouse that's still alive and doesn't tell the other party.
Or then, if it's a Christian, in a sense, if it was a biblical marriage, let's say two Christians get married and the man runs off with the secretary.
Right.
In a case like that, he's not free to marry again because he's still married to his wife.
Right. Yeah, got it. Mm-hmm.
But we have other things that the other part is we have to, a person has to be able to marry. But a more common problem is the problem of consent, that the heart of marriage is the exchange of vows, the intent, exclusive fidelity. I want to spend the rest of my life exclusively devoted to you. What could compromise that from happening? And there are a number of things. One thing is mistaken identity. Now, you'd say, well, that's pretty hard to believe you wouldn't know who the person was.
Yeah.
But sometimes what we'll have, and sometimes it involves fraud, is people will actually hide critical factors that would have been deal breakers if somebody knew. For example, not realizing, for example, that a person had spent time in prison.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean you couldn't marry, but that's something a person has a right to know.
Mm-hmm.
People create an artificial past and find out, wait a second, you don't realize here's the real story about that person. People have a right to know your basic biography.
Mm-hmm.
When you marry, they're saying, I want to spend my life with you. They need to know who you is.
Yes.
Not in an esoteric sense, but and there are a number of things that are potential deal breakers that if somebody had known, that might have changed their willingness. For example, infertility. There's nothing wrong with two people who sadly cannot have children or one, you know, getting married.
Uh-huh.
But you can't spring that on a spouse after the fact.
Got it. Yeah.
So two 22-year-olds who get married and then saying a week into this, I should have told you that I actually have a condition, I can't have children. Now, knowing that, people can accept this with joy.
Yeah.
But it's something a person has a right to. The same thing would be a serious illness.
Sure.
A person getting married who had a serious life-threatening illness, a partner needs to know they're getting into this.
Mm-hmm.
So they can freely say, this is the person I'm marrying.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who's had, for example, a struggle with same-sex attraction.
Mm-hmm.
Someone who's had a sexual relationship with somebody else. If they've lived with somebody, these things really happen.
Yeah.
Did you realize the person actually lived with somebody for a year and a half, a few years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they could get married, but they have a right to know that in evaluating, is this the person I want to spend the rest of my life with?
Sure.
So an issue like that could be, we call that mistaken identity. Another would be the absence for free and intelligent choice. Sometimes we have people just don't have enough preparation. They rush, you know, the classic, they run off and elope, and in marriage preparation, for example, in the Anglican Church in North America, it's a canonical requirement. We cannot officiate at weddings where people haven't prepped.
Right.
The judgment of one of the people might be compromised by something like drug use, for example, or mental illness, serious mental illness.
I see.
Or psychological distress. This is something. Sometimes we have people in a situation, we've been sexually intimate, who feel trapped, especially very young.
Mm-hmm.
Very conservative backgrounds. And again, marriage has to be a free choice, not that people feel trapped. The old shotgun wedding or something under duress.
Right.
Either outsiders are putting pressure or they feel pressure. That's the only way out. The only way I can save my reputation.
Yeah.
That's not a good reason to marry. And that could mean that people really weren't giving a free choice.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing is we have is marriage is about sexual intimacy is an essential part of marriage.
Yeah.
And sometimes there are things that prevent people from having a normal marital life. For example, some people have serious pornography issues that seriously affect their ability.
mm-hmm. yeah.
to have a normal life of sexual intimacy.
Yeah.
So what will happen in a case like this, Alex, like in our diocese, is somebody comes and they want to be married, and we ask, well, have you ever been married before? And they say, yes, but we're divorced. And our question will be, well, what happened? You know, basically, what are the circumstances?
Sure.
And we'll look and see whether, in fact, this isn't, the marriage clearly broke up. Often what breaks up a marriage was that one of these fatal things was missing.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly something. People get married because it was the easy way out. They were pregnant, etc. They were very young. And then suddenly, in no time at all, it breaks down.
Okay. So what we try to do, you're saying, is try to discover whether a sacramental marriage had actually taken place.
Yes.
This one flesh union thing had actually happened in the previous case. And if not, then they're free to remarry. If we can reasonably discover one of these factors.
Exactly right. We have to say, you know, absolutely, we can't change what Jesus told us.
Right.
We can't change the facts that they're what God has joined together. But we're saying, in circumstances, we'll find that, in fact, the reason the marriage broke down was precisely because one of those key factors
sure.
was not in place.
Okay.
That we didn't really have a marriage in the sense that Jesus meant. We had a legal
right.
marriage, but in Jesus' sense.
And often that's the case. It can be the case.
Yes, yeah. Frequently that can be the case. One of the obvious signs, not automatic, would be that often such marriages, we call them putative marriages, they were assumed in all good faith to be marriages,
mm-hmm.
Break down very quickly.
Okay. Yeah.
So we have situations, somebody was married for 2 or 3 months, you know,
right,
quickly
right.
came apart right away.
Uh-huh.
And clearly, why would something happen so fast? Is clearly there's some tremendous misunderstanding or,
sure.
or something was missing, something comes to the surface.
Uh-huh.
And so the real question isn't saying that for the rest of your life, this is the marriage thing. Actually, what we had here was a tragedy, but we never had that kind of that meeting of the minds, you know, two people, you know, a union for the rest of our lives, exclusive union for the purpose of bonding and procreation when that's possible.
Got it. I have one question to spring on you as well.
Okay.
What about marriages between people who are and are not Christians? Tell me about that. Would that be grounds for dissolving a marriage, and under what circumstances?
Well, there's something called the Pauline privilege. It's specifically in 1 Corinthians. Paul talks about the situation of what happens when somebody comes to the Lord and is baptized, and as a result of their baptism, first of all, Paul says in a case like that that that's not a basis to dump the spouse.
Wait, so as a result of their baptism, what happens?
What I'm saying is somebody's gotten baptized, and the first thing Paul dealt with in 1 Corinthians saying, does that allow the Christian spouse saying, now that I'm baptized, maybe I can start over, start a new life?
Okay, yeah.
And he says, no. Mm. He said, even if the spouse does not want to convert, he says, because the issue was, well, gee, you said that, you know, we're one flesh union. Well, if this person's worship, women were saying, if my husband's worshiping in a temple and pagan sacrifices, can I still be
yeah.
married to man like this? Mm-hmm. He said, yes. He said, I'm saying the believing brother, as he says, actually sanctifies the unbelieving spouse and could even win them over. So Paul says that's not a reason per se to say, okay, now that I'm a Christian, it means I can get rid of the spouse
right.
and start over. However, he does say, if the unbelieving spouse will not live in peace.
Mm.
I've actually seen, again, as working with this in our diet, I've actually seen a situation where someone, the spouse, refused to live with the spouse if they go to church on Sunday mornings.
Mm-hmm.
They found
mm-hmm.
it offensive. It was wasting their time. They didn't want that in their lives. No,
okay.
You can believe, but you can't go to church.
Right.
And the person had to choose, would they be a practicing Christian or not? And they chose to be a practicing Christian. Well, Paul says the person's not bound.
I see. Okay.
But this is called the Pauline privilege in tradition and canon law, and it's a very limited thing. It means a person who, as a result of their baptism, especially happens in more like mission territories and things, of their baptism, their existing spouse, you know, in their marriage, says, I will no longer live with you. I will not live with a Christian.
Right. Right.
So it's not the Christian deciding they could do better.
I see. Okay.
But they're simply saying, well, in that case, Paul said, the quote is, he says, I say that the brother or sister is not bound.
Okay. Got it. Okay. That makes sense. That makes sense.
Now, people could argue, does the bound mean that they don't have to still live with them, but they are free to remarry or not? But the church has traditionally thought that this would actually, in those very limited cases, open up the possibility of remarriage.
Okay. Yeah. That's okay. That's a helpful clarification. So what does the process look like in our, say, in our diocese, for instance? You know, someone comes, says, I've been married before, and I want to know if I'm free to marry again.
Well, what we do is we have a formulary, an application form, that basically asks the questions that are designed to find out, are any of these things we talked about that were essential really to have a Christian marriage missing somehow?
Mm-hmm.
It just lists different things. I think, was this true in your situation? A variety of information about the marriage. How long were you married? Was ever a good time? Did you have premarital instruction? These kind of things. It goes through a list of these. And then the person comes to the, and then if the priest or deacon they're talking to says, I think there's some merit here, they will bring it to the rector, you know, the person who's in, you know, the priest who's in charge of the parish. And if the priest looks and said, yeah, I think we have a real issue here about whether this person might be free to remarry, they will bring it to a dean. Our particular diocese has deaneries. We have four deaneries. You mm-hmm. go to the dean. And then if the dean says, yes, I think we have something here, it's referred to the bishop and the canon theologian, go through the material and look and see, do we have evidence? Does it seem, what are the possibilities that we have that would indicate that this legal marriage was not a marriage in the biblical sense of that lifelong commitment? It was certainly putative. It was certainly meant in all honor, but, you know, it was, from a Christian sense, not that lifelong indissoluble bond.
Sure.
And look at those different things. The bishop ultimately then makes a decision and will have what's called a declaration of nullity, which will say that no, from the church's vantage point, this was not the type of marriage that would prevent remarriage. This was not a biblical marriage in the sense of that lifelong union that we have no power to break.
Okay, and so that's an annulment.
That's an annulment,
okay.
Yes.
So that's something we share with Rome as well. Okay.
Yes. Although I'd say, like in our diocese, just some of the problems with the Roman process sometimes. For in our diocese, for example, it has no cost, and it's a quick process. I mean, it's a few months.
Sure.
It can be years, and sometimes there's some very significant legal costs.
Lag, I see. Okay.
So I should say that. Sometimes annulment, that term...
comes with baggage. Yeah.
Comes with baggage.
Well, great. Well, that makes a lot of sense, Father Stephen. Is there anything else that you'd tell us about Christian marriage before we close?
I think this is a real word of hope. I think one of the hardest things, you know... in a society, I grew up in a society where, you know, lifelong marriage was the norm, and now it's becoming mm-hmm. the exception. And what's really hard about this, there are two things about this teaching of Jesus, is one is it allows people to really give themselves.
Mm.
You see, I grew up in a world where one of the partners could really make big-time sacrifices, knowing that this is for us, because there is an us, and there will always be an us.
Yeah.
You know, for example, with one of the spouses going to medical school, the other person say, I can do the other stuff here to make that happen because this is us.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a lot of people would hesitate saying that I have no reason to know that 5 years from now, you know, all that, it also reinforces the notion. I think people are more careful about marrying, knowing that this is really how serious this is.
Mm-hmm.
That this is, the beautiful thing is that I can rely on this. I'm entering into a lifelong union.
Yeah.
There's something lasting I can depend on.
Mm.
So I could give myself to freely.
So you're saying like Jesus's hard teaching on this actually can enable the lifelong commitment that it requires. Like it having that understanding really gives you a safe place to really give yourself to your partner. Yeah.
I think the world is a lot harder in a world that we have now, which has sometimes been described in North America as serial polygamy.
One at a time.
Just one at a time. But, you know, the fact is where it's just routine that some people have starter marriages.
Yeah.
A world that accepts a divorce, now we officially do it for no reason at all other than I just feel I could do better.
Sure.
I'm just tired of this. I mean, there used to be at least some idea of there had to be. You know, it's funny. It's the only contract in America you can break without a reason.
Interesting. Yeah.
You know, if you're in business, all contracts, you know, that's why we have contracts. They're enforceable.
Right.
Marriage is the only, that I'm aware of, unenforceable contract that, you know, all that happens is by definition, if you decide, you just get out of it.
Yeah.
One party unilaterally can simply decide, I want out, and of course splits the property and on you move.
Yeah. Well, I can see how in that landscape that Jesus's words can really enable the lifelong commitment that it requires.
Well, as a business person most of my life, I don't say I could run a business if you had contracts knowing people could get out at will.
Yeah, right. Yeah, sure.
Without penalty. I mean, sure. I don't feel like delivering those goods tomorrow morning.
Yeah. And that is something that we talk about in the church. We did a series on marriage and sexuality earlier, that just that increased the seriousness of the commitment just increases the love that we have for one another, that the bonding and the romantic connection set that in a context of indissolubility, and it can, and that it really, it becomes itself.
Well, let me make a theological analogy with this. We've talked, I believe, in our program about the virtue of hope, elpis in Greek, has a different meaning. It means confident assurance.
Yeah.
Remember, I used the example of a medical student is in this country. If you get into medical, it's so hard to get into medical school that no one flunks in the sense that they don't have the brains to do it.
Right.
They might have personal problems that come up, but everyone is smart enough. If you get in medical school, that's not an issue. And right. You know you have a job, well, it's 100% employment.
Sure.
So even though it's really, really tough, knowing that confident assurance that 4 years I'm going to be a doctor, and I'm going to be respected, I'm going to have a job I love, that can get you through a lot. And that confident assurance in marriage is the same thing. You can do a lot in a marriage. Like I like to say in theology, the reason, faith is trust.
Yeah.
Hope means since we can trust someone, we can believe their promises. And since we can believe their promises, we have the freedom to give. Yeah. That's what love is. Because we're covered, now we can give without worrying.
Sure.
And I think the same thing's true as a marriage.
Yeah.
Is the beautiful thing, if marriage is forever, then that's the confident assurance allows love. Mm-hmm. Because then I can pour myself in 100% knowing that I don't have to worry about just kidding.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You have that confident assurance.
Yes, confident assurance.
Well, thank you so much, Father Stephen. That's all the time we have left for this episode. And thank you for listening to Word and Table. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with more on liturgy, sacrament, and the great tradition of Christian worship. Thanks for listening.